been here last time, like 4 years ago, so I'm very happy to be back. So I'll talk about some general aspects of opportunity breaking. It will be mainly based on a paper published with Nathan Zyberg from the Institute for Advanced Study a few months ago, and I will also present some results if I have time. So the general theme would be that I will present basically exact results when supersymmetry is broken. So this is the novelty of the approach. Usually people discuss exact results when supersymmetry is unbroken, versus BPS states and stuff like that, which you might be familiar with. And I will try to convince you that there is a lot to be discovered when supersymmetry is broken. And most interestingly, of course, when supersymmetry is broken, this is what we're interested in for particle physics. So we would be happy to have as many as we can exact results. So, of course, supersymmetry has played a major role in particle physics, cosmology, string theory, branches of mathematical physics, and presumably other areas, like condensed matter physics. So we have quite a good understanding of supersymmetric field theory. There are many exact results. People have developed a host of methods to ask various questions and to answer them. But we do not have as a good understanding of spontaneously broken supersymmetry. This is quite unfortunate, because if we want to make contact with experiments, we would better understand spontaneously broken supersymmetry as well as we can. So this motivates us to study spontaneous broken supersymmetry. So of course, I'll be discussing physics in four dimensions, and n equals one supersymmetry, which is the simplest setup relevant for phenomenology, particle physics, and so on. And one general prediction of spontaneously broken n equals one supersymmetry is that there is a massless fermion in the spectrum. This is the Goldfino, which I will denote G alpha throughout the way. So this is analogous to pion physics. If you have broken chiral symmetry, there is a massless pion, which is an exact result. So of course, we know that we expect a massless wild fermion when supersymmetry is broken. This is something that one has to keep in mind, and I will discuss the dynamics of this fermion in the talk. So, by studying this fermion, one may hope to elucidate some aspects of supersymmetry breaking, and maybe make contact with experiments. So there are many, many open questions in this field. Most of them have never been asked, even, and some of them that have been asked were not answered fully. So one question is, what is the connection between the UV physics and the Goldfino? So in many, many examples, what you do is just you write some Lagrangian, and then there is some indirect argument. Maybe the field theory even strongly coupled. There is some indirect argument that supersymmetry is broken. And then what you know is that there is this massless fermion at low energies, but you cannot say much more. You don't have any way to follow the dynamics of the strongly coupled field theory and see the massless fermion emerge out of the mess. So this is one possible question. And of course, once you answer the question of what is the connection between the ultraviolet and the infrared, you can ask more detailed questions of whether there is some useful superspace description, how do we parameterize supersymmetry breaking in strongly coupled field theories, and so on. Another question which is very important for phenomenologists is when you read phenomenology papers in particle physics, they will tell you that there are two kinds of supersymmetry breaking. One they call D-term, and the other they call F-term. Basically, in phenomenological papers, D-term breaking is when this Goldfino sits in a vector multiplex, and F-term breaking is when the Goldfino sits in a chiral multiplex. So this is the way they basically distinguish these two scenarios. But this was, yeah, so these two scenarios are also very useful in one set of examples and not useful in another set of examples. So there seems to be some distinction between two different kinds of supersymmetry breaking. So this is what you would gain by reading some of the literature on phenomenology. So the question is there any actual difference between D-term breaking and F-term breaking? And if yes, how is this encoded in the Goldfino Lagrangian? You will see in the end of the talk that we can develop some non-perturbative methods to answer this question, and the answer is that there is no such thing as D-term and F-term breaking. They are the same. Then you can ask, what are, for example, the interactions of the Goldfino particle with itself? So it's a free fermion at leading approximation, but then there is a bunch of nonlinear interactions, non-renormalizable operators that tell you what are the interactions of the Goldfino with itself. So one stab at this problem very early on in the 70s was by Akulov and Volkov, who wrote a very curious Lagrangian of this form. So they wrote some determinants of a bilinear in the Goldfino. When you expand this determinant, you get some non-zero vacuum energy at leading order, namely you expand it in the Goldfino. Then you get the kinetic term of the Goldfino, and then you get some quartic interactions and so on and so forth, sextic interactions. So this describes some very particular set of interactions of the Goldfino particle with itself. This Lagrangian was even written before supersymmetry was discovered. Now, we would like to understand what is the role of this Lagrangian in theories that break supersymmetry. What's the connection of this Lagrangian to supersymmetry breaking? And also, if you just do answer analysis, you see that G always appears together with G bar. So this Lagrangian predicts some U1 symmetry under which you can rotate the Goldfino. This is a bit confusing because there are some theories that break supersymmetry which don't have any symmetry, any global symmetry. So then, if you say that this Lagrangian has something to do with this series, it sounds confusing, because this Lagrangian has some extra symmetry. So we would like to understand what is the role of this symmetry. And lastly, we would like to understand whether there are corrections to this Lagrangian, and if yes, how do you describe them? So these are like some examples of open questions. So this in the Lagrangian that Akulov and Volkov wrote in the 70s, so this has nothing to do with supersymmetry. They wrote it to explain why the neutrino is massless or whatever. So F, is in their language, is just some dimensionful parameter which plays the role of the vacuum energy.
Well, I didn't
yet get to the connection of this Lagrangian to supersymmetry, but it's not an accident that I denoted this parameter by F. It will be the Susie breaking scale. It will be related to the Susie breaking scale. The dimensions? Yes, it's in four dimensions, so the dimensions are fine. F has dimension of mass squared. Mass squared. So the quartic and sextic interactions that follow from the expanding this determinant will have their typical scale F. This is the only scale in the problem. Right. So lastly, one practical question, if you wish, is that we know that there are some light particles in the standard model, electrons, positrons, photons, all that. And you would like to understand if indeed there is some broken supersymmetry in the world, you would like to understand what are the interactions of these light particles to the Goldfino. So the set of light particles is quite large. There are Higgs fields and electrons and photons. And each one of them has presumably a different leading interaction to the Goldfino particle. And you would like to classify these operators that connect us to the Goldfino, the visible sector, because they lead to some decays and so on. So you would like to have control over these operators. So this is one additional application you could imagine by understanding all this stuff. Right, so let me outline. So I will give you the tools with which you can address these questions. So I'll begin with some very basic examples of models that break supersymmetry to remind to those of you who have not been working on the subject for the last few years. Then I'll discuss some generalities of broken symmetries, or in general current algebras. I'll discuss some supercurrent multiplets, and then I will show you how to solve the first problem which I presented, which is how to follow the flow in strongly coupled field theories and find the connection between the ultraviolet and the Goldfino. Then I'll present some Lagrangians, which basically you will see how to couple electrons to Goldfinos and so on, and I will summarize. So I'll basically just give you the tools with which you can solve this problem. I will not have time to address all the possible issues. So now I'll just remind you of the simplest textbook examples of supersymmetry breaking theories. So this is quite simple. We consider a single chiral superfield phi. So a chiral superfield contains some boson, complex boson phi, some fermion which I call psi phi, and some auxiliary field big F. So now big F is not a number which is an auxiliary field whose equations of motion we have to solve, right? And the simplest Lagrangian that breaks supersymmetry is just a kinetic term for this chiral superfield phi and the superpotential term for this superfield phi. So it's a linear term. Now, this theory is completely free. In fact, it's completely boring. What this theory tells you is that there is some non-zero vacuum energy, which is given by this number F squared. The solution of the equation of motion of the auxiliary field will set big F to be small f. So there is some non-zero vacuum energy. So supersymmetry is formally broken. But this theory is free, and its spectrum is actually supersymmetric. The bosons do not interact with anything. The fermions do not interact. And the mass of the boson and of the fermion are just vanishing. So this is totally boring, but it breaks supersymmetry. So this is the simplest example that breaks supersymmetry. Now, to make it a bit more interesting and actually get the first non-trivial model that breaks supersymmetry, you amend the theory that I wrote before with some quartic term in the Taylor potential, some term that is quartic in this chiral superfield. So if you don't care about the details, what it does is to give some mass to this chiral, to this complex boson phi. So when you expand this guy, this Lagrangian in components, you get that the scalar potential for the complex scalar now has some quadratic term around the origin with a positive coefficient given by this parameter F squared over big M squared, where big M is the scale of the new physics that, you know, determines this quartic term. So we see that there is a vacuum when the scalar field vanishes. The vacuum energy is again F squared. I'm sorry, it should have been F squared here, not one. So the vacuum energy is F squared. And now the spectrum is non-trivial. The mass of the boson is, of course, some F over M from this, from reading out the curvature of this term, while the fermion remains massless. Of course, the fermion remains massless because it's the Gould theorem. All right? So this is the typical thing you would expect. You would expect some massless fermion and a bunch of massive bosons at masses which are at, like, proportional to the scale of the breaking scale F. All right? So this is the typical example to keep in mind. Now, I want to emphasize that there are many, many examples that break supersymmetry. You might have complained that this example is non-renormalizable, so do I have a renormalizable example that breaks supersymmetry? Well, the answer is that yes, there are many of them, and you can roughly divide them into three classes. One class is just renormalizable models of chiral superfields, namely theories of bosons and fermions whose dynamics break supersymmetry. So these models are never strongly coupled, and they appear all over the place. They appear, for example, in ISS, and the recent reincarnations of various Rafferty models, and so on and so forth. Now, there is a class of what we call calculable dynamical models. These are models that do have strong coupling, but this kind of strong coupling that we can deal with using holomorphy and exact results, mainly to Zyberg. So this class includes the 3-2 model, which was solved in the 80s by Affleck, Dine, Zyberg, various models based on deformed quantum moduli spaces that ITIY, if you are familiar with, is one example. And then the recent model of massive superplasticity by Intrilegator, Zyberg, and Chi. So these are models in which there is some strong dynamics, but we can deal with it. And lastly, there is a set of models which have strong dynamics, and we don't know what to do with them. There are only indirect evidence that supersymmetry is broken. So this is like, so one example of such a theory is if you take an SU5 gauge theory and add something that looks like one generation of the standard model field. So you add 1.10 and 1.5 bar to an SU5, and you don't have any superpotential that you can write, and this theory is strong, and there is an indirect Hooft anomaly matching argument that it breaks supersymmetry, but nobody has ever proven that. So there are all these different kinds of theories, and you would like to understand whether there are any general principles common to all these examples. So now I would like to set up the question in a bit more general setup, such that we can address this general question. So I would like to review the main idea in current algebras, because this will be very useful for me. So the basic idea is that if you have a continuous symmetry in quantum field theory, there is a conserved charge Q, and we can associate to this conserved charge Q a conserved current. So it's a divergentless current, d mu j mu 0. Now, what's nice about this equation is that even if the symmetry is spontaneously broken, this equation still holds. So the conservation equation still holds even if the symmetry is spontaneously broken. This is an operator equation, essentially. What the signal of symmetry breaking is not that this equation does not hold. Rather, it's that the charge that you get by integrating the zero component of the current diverges in the infrared at long distances. The reason that it diverges is that there is a massless particle now, a pion or a good phenom, and massless particles tend not to decay fast enough. So we see that this equation still holds. The charge itself is not well defined, and this is the signal of symmetry breaking. But in spite of this, this is the main idea of current algebra. Commutators of the charge with any local operator are still well defined. These are well-defined local operators. So if you take the charge and you calculate the commutator with any local operator, you'll get on the right-hand side a bunch of local operators. And these equations still hold even if the symmetry is broken. The reason that the commutator is well-defined, although the charge is not well-defined, is that when you calculate the commutator, there are basically two terms intuitively. There is QO minus OQ. And the tail from these massless particles cancels. So there is some tail from massless particles, and when you take the minus sign, it cancels. So this is the reason that these are well-defined operators. So this is very powerful, because we conclude that even if some symmetry is spontaneously broken, you can still use the symmetry to classify operators. So all the operators still fit in representations of the symmetry, even if the symmetry is broken. So this is important to remember. Now let's apply the same logic for supersymmetry. In supersymmetry, the current that is conserved has also a spinor index, but this doesn't matter. You can think of it as some index that measures the number of symmetries you've got. So you have some conserved supercurrent, d mu s mu alpha is zero. So this is the notion of n equals one supersymmetry, that there is one conserved supercurrent with a spinor index in four dimensions. Now you can ask yourself, how do I complete this supercurrent into a multiplex of supersymmetry? So as I tried to convince you before, this question makes perfect sense even if supersymmetry is broken. This multiplex will exist anyway. Because this, what I have to do to write down the multiplex is to start from S mu alpha and calculate commutators, the anti-commutators of Q with S mu alpha or Q dagger with S mu alpha. So you calculate Q with S mu alpha, Q dagger with S mu alpha, eventually you stop. Because these representations are finite. And you get some nice multiplet, which makes sense even when supersymmetry is broken. All right? So when you start calculating these guys in any given model, whatever, or your favorite model of supersymmetry breaking, what you will find is the energy momentum tensor. One of these operators on the right hand side will be the energy momentum tensor. So this is not very surprising because you know that the algebra of supersymmetry Q dagger with Q contains the energy momentum tensor on the right hand side. So eventually you do expect to find the energy momentum tensor. You also find some R current, which may not be conserved. So it is some current that is conserved in the UV, but may be violated by relevant deformations, for example. So it's not very interesting, but it's just important to remember that you find some kind of R current. And most curiously, when you start writing down these commutators, what you find is that you have to introduce a new operator, small x, which I don't have a name for, except for small x. It's not something that you're familiar with. And all these operators can be explicitly written in any given microscopic theory. So if you like this model, for example, which I will do in detail after I get some exact results to show you how these exact results are being realized, you can write down this small x, the energy momentum tensor, the supercurrent in this model, and you can check that they satisfy commutation relations. Right. So what the first question which I would like to answer is, what is this small x? What is this role? Right. So are there any questions about
this? So let me give you a nice way to package this multiplet. Let's start calculating Q and Q dagger.
So there is a nice way to package the resulting representation or multiplet if you want. And the way to package it is to just write it down in superspace using this theta of coordinates in superspace. So in the linear component in theta, you find the supercurrent. So it's some particular linear combination of the supercurrent. And then, as I told you, you find some R current. Sorry, there should be an R here. You find some R current in the book, in some other component of the representation. And you find the energy momentum tensor in yet another entry of this representation. And this guy X sits in theta squared and theta bar squared. So X is completely crucial for the closure of this representation. As I will now emphasize again, we would like to understand this mysterious complex scalar field X. So if you don't like multiplets and you are more fond of old-fashioned current algebras, you can just write down operator equation, Q dagger acting on the supercurrent contains the energy momentum tensor, some R current, while Q acting on the supercurrent contains this guy X. Now these equations, you should make quickly some consistency checks on this equation because you know the algebra of supersymmetry. You know the Q dagger with Q is the energy momentum tensor without any extension. So you have to integrate both sides of these equations over space, and you will see that these guys become total derivatives, and only this guy survives. So you get the correct algebra of supersymmetry. Similarly, you know that Q with Q is zero, so when you integrate over space, this guy should go to zero. And indeed, it becomes a space-like derivative, so it goes to zero. So this is what we call, technically, in current algebra, Schwinger terms. These are terms that appear when you calculate commutators of currents with currents or currents with charges, but when you integrate over space, they disappear because they are total derivatives.
Could there be a non-zero boundary term from those? Oh, when you look at it, you usually assume that everything decays.
Various things are spontaneously broken. So before, for example, integral Q did.
Right, so there are examples in which the effect you mentioned plays a very crucial role. That something that looks like a Schwinger term does not go away, and the algebra is being modified.
So some central terms in extended supersymmetry algebras can appear due to that. But in n equals 1 supersymmetry, you can show that there aren't any consistency boundary terms that you can write. So even if there are massless particles, these terms conspire to decay fast enough. They cancel each other.
Is n equals 1 supersymmetry?
Yes.
I don't think so.
You have BPS strings in n equals 1.
No, BPS particles. But then they break Lorentz invariants.
Yes, but you would be on the rest of the side.
Right, so I'm interested in, you know, the algebra should respect Lorentz invariants. I mean, if you write down the supersymmetry algebra on the string, then you might see something like that. But if you write the algebra in four-dimensional space, then
there is... But you do this exercise, you'll find that there is a field which has a derivative because of the finite Lorentz interaction which you identify with the string. Usually in a state,
yes,
you consider that charge is zero, but in principle, it's zero.
Yes, but the solution that you are expanding around, yeah, because it's a long string, it usually breaks the boundary conditions by hand.
Yeah.
So what I'm considering is the path integral which prescribes boundary conditions in some super selection sector, mm-hmm. And then you cannot have it.
Yeah.
It's right. It's correct that if you expand around some, a long string is not even a soliton. It's not in your Hilbert space because it breaks the boundary conditions. So then the story is completely different. The fields have completely different boundary conditions. In principle, the algebra, these are all, if you just assume that everything is decaying fast enough, that you will see that this all becomes phase derivatives. So this is another way to explain why this X, if you take your favorite microscopic model, you write down S mu alpha in components, and you calculate Q with this S mu alpha, you will find something on the right hand side. This something will integrate to zero when you do the space integral, but it should be there, so we call it X.
Can I just ask, with these boundary conditions, Q is not divergent in the infrared?
Q itself is divergent.
It still is.
Yes. And the commutators of Q with anything else are convergent.
How is Q divergent if you've imposed these boundary conditions?
Because the current, the supersymmetry current, contains a good phenom when supersymmetry is broken.
Mm-hmm.
And this decays like 1 over x, which is not sufficiently quick to make an integral over this 3x convergent. So you impose boundary conditions, but in the presence of a particle, these boundary conditions become there. So this is the signal for symmetry breaking, that the charge does not exist. But the current is still sensible. This is correct. So let me tell you just one additional way to package all this information, which will be the most revealing. So let's look again at this multiplet.
It contains some supercurrent, and it contains an energy momentum sensor, and also some R current, which may not be conserved. But anyway, these two guys have to be conserved. So there has to be a conservation equation that you should be able to write nicely in superspace if you want, that will tell you that these guys are conserved and that this guy is symmetric. Of course, you can say that it's components to write down these equations in components, but it's most revealing to write down this equation in superspace. And the solution of this problem, which I'll not have time to describe now, is to impose the following equation. If you impose the d bar, it looks very strange, but anyway, this is the equation. D bar of j alpha alpha dot is d alpha of x, where x is some chiral superfield. It turns out that if you just, you know, solve the following simple algebraic exercise of trying to find a superfield j alpha alpha dot, which is the same as j mu, it's a vector index, that is real and satisfies an equation that looks like d bar of this guy is d alpha of some chiral superfield, it turns out that there is a unique solution to this equation, and this solution is exactly takes exactly this form with conserved energy momentum sensor and the conserved supercurrent. So the conservation equations follow from the imposition of this equation. So this is like the conservation equation in superspace, and this operator big X turns out, well, let's parameterize it in the following way. It turns out that the bottom component of big X is exactly the guy that I told small x. All right? So it turns out that this operator small x, which we want to understand, sits in some chiral superfield in the bottom component. The theta component and the theta squared component of this chiral superfield big X are some projections. So the fermion, the fermionic component, is the spin a half projection of the supercurrent. And the theta squared component is the vacuum energy, the trace of the energy momentum tensor, and a divergence of this non-conserved R current. So this is just the solution of this equation. It's a very simple algebraic exercise. You can find the general vector, the general superfield that solves this equation, and then you can find x in terms of the components of this guy. So the bottom component is small x, the theta component is the spin a half projection of the supercurrent, and the theta squared component is some combination of the trace of the energy momentum sensor plus some divergence of the non-conserved R current. So we learn that X sits in the bottom component of some chiral superfield. Now I should explain what it means to have this spin a half projection of the supercurrent. This is the most interesting part of this. This is the most interesting conclusion from this analysis. So unlike in chiral symmetries, where the currents are vectors, J mu, in supersymmetry, as I told you, the supercurrent also has a spinor index alpha. It's S mu alpha. So therefore, the supercurrent is not in an irreducible representation of Lorentz, unlike usual chiral symmetries. Because it has additional index, you can decompose the supercurrent into two different pieces. One has a spin 3 a half, so it has one from the left SU2 and a half from the right SU2. And the other is exactly the spin a half projection, which has only charges under the right SU2. It's spin a half under the right SU2. To get this spin a half projection, you can just act on S mu alpha with the sigma matrix in this fashion. So you construct one, the indices, and leave only one fermionic input. Now, it is known that when supersymmetry is broken, S mu alpha should become the Goldstino, low energies. In fact, the more detailed result is that the spin a half component of the supercurrent becomes the Goldstino. This is the one that has the right quantum numbers, because the Goldstino has a spin a half. So it turns out that when supersymmetry is broken at very, very low energies, the spin a half projection of the supercurrent is proportional to the Goldstino field, while the spin tree half component decouples from low energies. So it contains derivatives of the Goldstino and so on. So it basically has more factors of momentum. So at very, very low energies, the only thing that survives from the supercurrent is the spin half component, and it's proportional to the Goldstino. Right? So we see something very nice about the superfield X. We see that in the theta squared component, we see the vacuum energy, basically. This is the trace of the energy momentum sensor. And now we understand that at very, very low energies, the theta component is the Goldstino. So this superfield starts smelling like something that we're familiar with from phenomenological studies of supersymmetry, which is what they call the spurion. This is the guy that, you know, contains the vacuum energy in the theta squared component and the Goldstino in the theta component. Only that the claim is that the spurion field exists only in weakly coupled models, where you can explicitly write down some chiral superfield that has the vacuum energy in it. Well, what I'm showing you here is that you can, in every model of supersymmetry breaking, abstractly define this X in terms of the microscopic degrees of freedom. And you know that at very low energies, the theta component of X flows to the Goldstino, the theta squared component flows to the vacuum energy, and it only remains to be seen what does small X flow to. So this is now easy to guess, because, so I'll get to it in one page. In the next transparency, or like two next transparencies. So now it's very easy to guess what this small x is, which is the abstract of all this discussion. We know that the theta component is the Goldstino at very low energies. So whatever x is in terms of the microscopic degrees of freedom, it could be something very complicated. At very low energies, x should be the friend of the Goldstino under supersymmetry transformations. And we know that x is bosonic, and it's complex. So there is only one reasonable guess, that X is the Goldstino bilinear. And this is, at this point, it's a guess, but you'll see that it must be correct. Now, you don't know the coefficient in this relation, but it can be fixed by supersymmetry. What we're basically saying is that this superfield X flows at very low energies to some superfield that has a Goldstino bilinear at the bottom component, something linear in the Goldstino at the theta component, and the vacuum energy at the theta squared component. So the coefficients can be fixed by requiring that this is a nice representation of supersymmetry. And this gives exactly this coefficient 2 and f and square root of 2 and all that. Now, if you just stare at the superfield, you discover that it satisfies a very curious equation that x squared is 0. So this is a very surprising equation, because if you would be asked, like if I were asked before whether this equation on chiral superfields have any solution, I would say probably just the trivial 0 solution. But it turns out that this equation has a non-trivial solution, which is given by this polynomial in the Goldstino field, if you want, or in general in some fermion. So we see an exact result. So this is an exact result in any supersymmetry breaking theory, that you can write down some operator in the ultraviolet that is this big X. For example, if you care about this FE5 model, which I mentioned in the beginning, which is incalculable, which people call it incalculable, in this model, this guy small x is just the Gaugino condensate, which is some operator in this strongly coupled theory. What I'm telling you is that this operator big X flows to something that we understand very well at low energies. So it's the Goldstino bilinear, the Goldstino, and some vacuum energy. And it satisfies this curious equation x squared equals 0. So we can calculate correlation functions at very long distances in every supersymmetry breaking theory, exactly. We can fix all the coefficients even. And it's model independent. It's a universal result.
The only
degrees
of freedom will be the
Goldstino. So
generically, the only degree of freedom would be the Goldstino and some axions. You know, some other pions, maybe there are some other U1 symmetries that are broken. So generically, there are like a bunch of Goldstone bosons and Goldstinos and some fermions maybe to cancel proof phenomenon matching. But other than that, everything is massive. And you can check that even if the low energy theory contains additional massless particles to the Goldstino, that these relations will not be modified. I'll get to it in the end of the talk. So for in the meantime, if you want to keep it simple, assume that there is only a Goldstino at very low energy. But then there is a gap. And there is a gap besides the Goldstino, right? Yeah.
Right. So usually people, so when people discuss the anomaly multiplet, they discuss it only
in the context of unbroken supersymmetry. What I'm telling you here is that because this is an operator equation, and I motivated the fact that all the operators still furnish nice representations of supersymmetry, so this equation still makes sense even if supersymmetry is broken. So in the anomaly multiplet, this X is usually thought of as a nuisance, something you have to get rid of. It's not very interesting. It's like a conformal anomaly or something. But when supersymmetry is broken, there is a very interesting story that this X is in some sense a solvable sector of the theory. It's part of unsolvable sector because it flows to something that we understand exactly. So this, it flows at low energies to this polynomial, and we can calculate correlation functions of X exactly. And the results are universal, independent of the theory that breaks the symmetry. And then you see also this equation, Curie's equation X squared equals zero. So now I have to go back to Yutaka's question. The D-transfer F-transfer did not play any role in this argumentation, right? So the Golfino always fits in a chiral superfield, or it can be made to fit in a chiral superfield by changes of variables. So of course there are models in which you can put it either in a vector field or a chiral superfield. What I showed it is that there is a canonical choice that follows from the supercharged algebra, in which the Golfino fits in a chiral superfield. There is no unambiguous distinction between D terms or F terms. And what we find here, which is also interesting, is that this guy X, it generalizes the notion of spurion in supersymmetry breaking theories. But a spurion is usually thought of as existing only in Whisky coupled models, while we show that it exists in general. Right? So are there any questions up to this point?
So the plan of the rest of the talk would be
that I will show you in a very simple example how does this constraint arise, like in Whisky coupled examples. And before that, I will show you how to write Lagrangian, how to understand this Akulov-Volkov theory in this language, very simply. So this Akulov-Volkov theory, I would remind you. Yes?
F is the vacuum energy. It's a trace of the energy momentum tensor.
Okay, so in that case, a D, F corresponds.
Yeah, so what I call F is just the vacuum energy, whether it comes from D terms or F terms. That's
the alpha.
Hmm?
The parameter or complex?
Oh, F by itself, that what I define F in this is a complex parameter, but the vacuum energy is the absolute value of these guys' words. So I should remind you that Akulov-Volkov theory is this mysterious object with the determinant of the Goldstein. And I would like to shed light on what is the role of this theory in all this business. So now that we found this nice chiral superfield, X non-linear, and we have to bear in mind that it satisfies this nice nilpotent constraint, X squared non-linear equals zero,
we can try to write Lagrangians. So these Lagrangians that we're going to write describe theories with spontaneously broken supersymmetry. But I'm giving you a very easy way to get to write Lagrangians with spontaneously broken supersymmetry. What I'm telling you is that use whatever you're familiar with from unbroken supersymmetry, just write scalar potential, superpotential, and terms that you know you like with covariant derivatives, without covariant derivatives, whatever you want, like you do in general when supersymmetry is unbroken. But now, in the end of the calculation, you can impose this constraint to solve for one of the degrees of freedom in X non-linear. So usually, the chiral superfield would contain a boson in the bottom component, some independent complex scalar. In my case, the constraint removes this boson, and instead, what we have in the bottom component is a bilinear in the fermion. So you should write Lagrangians in terms of this X nonlinear as if supersymmetry was unbroken, but imposing the constraint. So this is a very neat way to write Lagrangians that break supersymmetry. And it turns out that if you write the simplest, you remember the simplest model that breaks supersymmetry, that is completely trivial because it was free, so it's this guy. Now I'm writing the same theory in terms of X nonlinear. And now it becomes slightly less trivial. I'm writing a kinetic term for X nonlinear and the linear term in the superpotential. But now, because of the constraint, this theory is not free. There are some bilinear single spinors and quartics and so on hanging all over the place. And when you write down this theory in components, this is what gives you the Akulov-Volkov theory. So this is a very simple description of the Akulov-Volkov theory, basically the free theory that breaks supersymmetry. But instead of x, you have x squared equals 0. And now we also understand where this symmetry came from. In this description, it's clear that it's an accidental R-symmetry, because this theory has some invariance under x going to x times some phase, accompanied by some rotation of theta. And this is invariant. So this is invariant and this is invariant. So this is some accidental R-symmetry. Corrections to this term, to this theory, in terms of x non-linear, will break the symmetry eventually. And you can prove that if you look at the very, very low energy, without, you know, with the minimal number possible of derivatives, this theory is unique. You could ask me, why didn't I write x nonlinear to the power 4? Where, because x nonlinear squared equals 0, you cannot write it down, it just vanishes. So if you're interested in Lagrangians without any derivatives, you can prove that this is the unique Lagrangian. Okay? So you can rigorously prove that there is only one Lagrangian, and this is the Lagrangian. So the Akula-Volkoff theory, the role of the Akula-Volkoff theory is to describe the interactions of the Golcino with itself at very, very low energies. And it only captures some universal part of the Lagrangian. This is the completely universal part. Corrections to this Lagrangian may depend on the high energy physics. But this Lagrangian is universal. And this also explains why there must be an accidental symmetry. There are some theories in which there is an unbroken R symmetry. And because this Lagrangian is universal, it must respect all the possible accidental symmetries. Otherwise, it could not have been a universal theory at low energy. So this is a sort of a roundabout argument, but it explains why R symmetry must be present in this Lagrangian. And as I said, corrections are controlled by some derivative expansion. And these corrections will not be universal, unlike this guy. So when you expand this guy in components, you find the vacuum energy, the kinetic term of the Golcino, and then a bunch of interactions of the Golcino with itself. For example, the leading guy is this vortex in the Golcino. All right? So are there any questions about this?
So now I would like to show
how all these rather abstract ideas about the existence of x non-linear and the nilpotent equations arise dynamically from the RG flow in the simplest model that we can think about. So the simplest model, which is non-trivial enough, is what I gave you in the beginning. It's this free theory amended by a quartic interaction in the ultraviolet, such that the boson, there is a fermion and there is a boson, and there is a non-zero vacuum energy. The fermion is massless, the boson is massive. So at very, very low energy, if you want to describe the theory of the fermion, you have to integrate out the boson, which is massive. So you go below the energies of the mass of the boson. You integrate it out, and then you find some theory of the fermion. And I want to show you how this integration out, or in other words, the RG flow, generates dynamically a nilpotent constraint. Well, here, of course, there is no nilpotent constraint. All the chiral supercells are linear. They have bosons and fermions. So there isn't anything funny going on. So the way to do it is when you want to integrate out a massive guy, what you do is just to write down the Lagrangian zero momentum, and then you solve the equation of motion. That's the first approximation, right? So when you want to write down the zero momentum piece in this Lagrangian, it turns out that it all comes from here. This is the kinetic term, so there is no zero momentum, intuitively. So all the zero momentum guys come from this interaction. When you expand it in components, which is rather easy to do, you find the following object. You find some boson times the vacuum energy minus a fermion bilinear. And now, you see, usually, you don't write these terms with the fermion when you want to read out the mass. When you want just to read out the mass of the boson, you forget about the fermion, and you see that what it gives is a mass term. From this times that, you get some mass term. So you integrate it out. But now I want to do the integration out a bit more precisely. Usually, we just set it to zero because it's massive. But I want to keep the fermion in general. So I have to solve the equations of motion in the presence of these fermions bilinear. So the equations of motion are very simple, and you immediately see that when you take a derivative with respect to phi dagger, you get the following equation of motion. You get that the complex boson is traded for a fermion bilinear over 2f. And this reminds you, of course, of what I got for this small x. You see that this, now let's do one step ahead. we go back to this general chiral supertube phi, which has this independent boson in the bottom component. And now let's plug the solution back to big phi. So we see that big phi flows to some superfield, which turns out to be this axial linear, in which the bottom component is now psi squared over 2f. The theta component is what it used to be. It's just a fermion. I didn't do anything with the fermion. And then the theta squared is some is this auxiliary field. So we see that phi flows dynamically to exactly what I told before, axial linear. Furthermore, it satisfies an ill-potent constraint. So we see that this chiral superfield, which was linear and nice, satisfies at low energies an ill-potent constraint. And it looks exactly like we predicted. Of course, this result also holds in non-perturbative theories. So this is just an example. Now, I want to show you how the Akulov-Volkov Lagrangian arises. So at very low energies, phi should be substituted by this superfield containing only the fermion. It satisfies an ill-potent constraint. So the first approximation is just to take this superfield and plug it back to the action, right? When you do it, this term goes away because phi squared is zero. So what you remain is phi bar phi and f phi. And now phi is basically axial linear. So you see that you recover the Akulov-Volkov Lagrangian just because, and you recover both the constraint and the Akulov-Volkov Lagrangian at very low energies. When you do the integration out more precisely, there is some systematic way of doing this integration out. When you expand in the mass of the massive, in the mass of the boson, then of course you'll generate some corrections to the Akulov-Volkov theory. But at very, very low energies, which is what we've done so far, zero momentum, you find exactly the Akulov-Volkov theory and the nonlinear constraint. Now, to complete the presentation of this example, I would like to show you what is big X in this theory. So I so far showed you that some superfield phi flows to something that looks nilpotent, and you recover the Akulov-Volkov theory. But now let me connect to what I defined before to be big X. So you can calculate the supercurrent in this model. You can calculate the energy momentum tensor. And you can calculate the whole multiplex, purely JMU, the supercurrent energy momentum tensor. And then by using this conservation equation, you can also extract what is big X in this theory. And big X looks like this horrible object. So it has something that looks nice. It's F phi in the bottom component. But it has some UV physics dependence. It has this big, this scale big M in it, and with this ugly operator. But at low energies, it becomes very simple. At low energies, because phi squared becomes zero, as we showed, X becomes just F times phi. This is big X. It becomes small F times phi, very low energies. And because phi is nilpotent, X itself becomes nilpotent. So this is just to complete the proof of what I showed before in this weakly coupled model. This operator big X is well defined in the ultraviolet. It's very non-trivial in the ultraviolet. At low energies, it becomes extremely simple. It flows to this X non-linear, and it becomes nilpotent. All right. So this is a demonstration of this fact in this model. And furthermore, if you were a phenomenologist trying to parameterize supersymmetry breaking in this theory, you would call the Spurian this guy phi, because this is what acquires a non-zero F term. And indeed, at very low energies, X flows to phi. So it becomes, it generalizes the notion of a Spurian. Now, one miracle in all these equations is that none of the interesting equations depended on the scale big M. If there were any dependence, it would mean that there is some UV sensitivity, and the results that I'm getting are not universal. But you see that all the nice equations, like this one, and the result of X at very low energies where this disappears, none of them depend on big N. So this is another hint that these results are universal. The scale of UV somehow cancels miraculously in all these complications. How much time else do I have? All right. So far I've been discussing only the Gaussian, and as I've been asked, you should worry that there might be some additional massless particles in interesting examples of supersymmetry breaking. In particular, we have the standard model particles, like the photon is exactly massless. So you should ask whether the results I told you are modified or not. So here I'll present some new results, a mixture of new results and old results. It turns out that when you have this, in general, bunch of massless particles in the infrared, the Golovkino and other particles, this equation x squared equals zero is just the brink of the iceberg. It's just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, there is a much more general structure which looks very similar in the in some mathematical sense. So the idea is that if you have some matter fermions like electrons, which are very light or massless, it doesn't matter whether they are very light or massless, this equation always holds because it has to do with the presence of a Golovkino. But then you introduce another superfield Q, and it satisfies this equation x times Q equals zero. So you see that there is some nice Nilpotent structure when you introduce massless fermions like Hooke fermions. So they should be described by some superfields that satisfy this equation. And every such equation gives you some new exact results.
No, well, you can always make, in some sense, changes of variables such that, you know, all the new fields will be orthogonal to them. What this equation tells you, intuitively, is that this superfield Q used to be something that contained a boson, a fermion, and an auxiliary field. What this equation tells you is that now the superfield Q only contains a fermion. This is what, in the end of the day, this equation tells you. It means that the boson, the selectron, if you want, is no longer part of the theory. You integrate it out. The analogy is that this equation, what it really tells you is that the boson in X nonlinear, that used to be complex scalar in one of them, is no longer part of the theory. So the way to get rid of it is to impose a supersymmetric equation. That, you know, the solution of this equation will get rid of the scalar field in the bottom component. So this equation is, in some sense, a generalization of this equation. But in general, the result is that when you have all these massless particles, you can calculate more and more exact results, whereas correlation functions, and you get a nice structure of something that looks like a nilpotent ring or whatever it is, but there is a definite ring structure. And you get a bunch of exact results, even in any calculable models. So this is if you want to introduce some fermions. Now, if you have some gauge fields, you want to impose maybe a Wesel-Mino gauge. This is done by this nilpotent equation. If you have gauge fields and you want to get rid of the gauge genus, because you know that there is only a photon, which is massless, you impose this equation. And if you want to describe fixed fields, which are very light, because of fine-tuning, for example, like in the standard model, you would impose a very strangely looking equation, but it's correct. You impose an exonlinear times h bar is a chiral superfield. So this is a chiral superfield times an anti-chiral superfield, which is still chiral. This equation has a non-trivial solution. It's like saying that this equation has a non-trivial solution, which is also surprising, because you would say that maybe both of them should vanish. But this equation that some chiral times anti-chiral is chiral has a non-trivial solution, and it describes a single scalar field, a single complex scalar field, without its fermion superpartner. And finally, if you have some axions or Goldstone bosons, which is very common in theory to break supersymmetry, this is the equation that you have to impose. You have to introduce some superfield curly A that satisfies this equation, and you can solve these equations very easily. Like, the solution to this equation I presented in great detail is this g squared plus theta g plus theta squared f, and it's a very simple exercise to solve this equation. Similarly, you can solve all these equations by expanding the superfields in theta and calculating the various components, and this gives you a bunch of superfields and couplings. So, for example, one application that you can imagine is that now that you have this result, you can look for the universal Lagrangian. Let me maybe write one equation. So, in the case that there was, is it visible here? Is it visible? Okay. So, in the case that there was only one Golovkino, I told you that the universal Lagrangian looked like the first thing you would write down. So this is the universal Lagrangian, and this gives you all the interesting couplings of the Golovkino to itself. In particular, it gives this the leading coupling of the Golovkino to itself, which is this guy. Now you would like to understand, for example, what is the coupling of electrons and positrons to Golovkino. So this is extremely hard to do if you just work in components with nonlinear supersymmetry.
and it was an open problem for a long time. It still got confused, and there were many contradicting answers in the literature. In this language, it's extremely easy. What you have to do is just to write down supersymmetric Lagrangians and impose the constraint. So when I want to include fermions, I just look at the first constraint, x non-linear times q non-linear is 0. So the simplest Lagrangian you could imagine is a kinetic term for the Goldstino and the kinetic term for the electron. So this again, and then some supersymmetry breaking in the Goldstino. So this is the simplest thing you can write down, which is consistent with some U1 symmetry under which the electron rotates to itself, for example. So this theory looks free and boring, but because of the constraint, because of these constraints, it's actually non-trivial, and it contains interesting interaction terms. So by analyzing this theory, you can read out the leading coupling of two electrons to two Goldstinos. It comes from this guy. And the result is that it's the electron times the Goldstino times box of the electron times the Goldstino bar, 1 over f squared. And the coefficient is fixed. So for example, the coupling, yes.
If I wrote this out in the components, an algorithm that you could have used to try and couple the Goldstino and the other fields would be build a sphere bind out of the
Right, so I can tell you, so yes, the way people previously thought about this problem is indeed what you said. It's to write down everything in components and construct sphere binds and field binds in general. And try to write Lagrangians that have on-shell supersymmetry, just, you know, with these transformation rules that they introduced by him. And then, of course, check for source consistency. There are two problems with this approach. One is that it's extremely hard to technically carry out.
I'm afraid to expand the problems. If I just take your component version of your Lagrangian, do I get that?
Okay, so if you do it correctly, if you do, you know, the other thing correctly, you get an agreement, of course. Because they both are, they contain the same physics. The problem with the other approach is that it's extremely technically complicated to carry out, and in this approach we could get results which were ambiguous in the literature up to date. I mean, it was too complicated to carry out. With this approach that you are mentioning, it's very easy to get couplings of one Goldstino to whatever you want. But if you are interested in decay modes of electrons to two Goldstinos, which is the leading coupling in these two electrons, then it's really hard. It's possible to do it correctly. But what is even harder is that if you are interested in correction, so this coupling of two electrons to two Goldstinos is an exact result when supersymmetry is broken. It's completely universal. But then, for some phenomenological reasons, you might have been interested in corrections to this vertex. You could do it with the other approach, but you would have to carry it out to very high orders, and it would be very complicated. In this approach, all you have to do is to write down the next term in the Keeler potential that is not vanishing. I wouldn't write something like x non-linear, q non-linear, because it's vanishing, but the next term that you can write down is the derivative q non-linear squared. Okay? This guy gives you the next corrections of coupling, you know, those Goldstino electrons without any further work. The reason for the fact that this is simpler than what they used to be doing is that this is an off-shadow description of non-linear supersymmetry. Well, more often than not, what they were doing is a non-shadow description. So every time you add a new term to the Lagrangian, you change the equations of function, and you have to do it from the start. Because you have the symmetries only on shadow. Anyway, so this is extremely trivial. Just write down whatever you want. And this term, for example, gives you the next correction to an electron-positron coupling to those fields. But anyway, this is an example of an exact result, another exact result that you can calculate regardless of the smoothly breaking theory. So you have this huge ring of constraints that look Grassmannian when supersymmetry is broken. And it would be interesting to understand, like, both phenomenologically and mathematically what it means and where it comes from. Right, so let me just conclude. I try to convince you that supersymmetry and superspace are useful even when supersymmetry is broken, which is a bit strange, but it's true. And then we saw that we can follow the supercurrent multiplet and the associated X superfield along the flow to get some equations at the infrared, like X flows to the Goldstino, and we see that X squared is 0.
we can find the interactions of the Gaussian and some other particles, like I did on the board and in the previous slide. And we saw that the deep low energy theory is universal, and it has a nice mathematical structure. There are many open questions. One mathematical question is to understand the geometry behind all these constraints. Like it forms some kind of ring, but I'm not sure whether mathematicians studied such rings. And what's surprising is that these equations have some non-trivial solutions. Now, you can study phenomenological consequences of Gaussian coupling, and there are many different places in which knowing the couplings might actually help, like supernova or axions and many different, especially bound planar axions. And now you would like to understand how to gauge supersymmetry. Eventually, we believe that there is supergravity also, so it would be interesting to understand how all this stuff is affected by local supersymmetry when supersymmetry is gauged. And then, of course, you would like to find even more exact results when supersymmetry is broken. So that's all. Thanks.
Yes.
So you're saying there's no correction or real correction to the constraint itself. It's only correction.
Exactly. The corrections are in the Lagrange and the constraint.
But so the constraint, they do the same thing as solving the equivalent of solving the equation function.
Yes. So if you just solve, if you just took this, okay, I understand what you're asking, I'll give you an answer. If you just take this model and you start solving the equations of motion of the scalar, indeed, at leading order you get this solution, and when you plug it back, you get this equation. And it looks nilpotent. If you try to solve the equations of motion of the scalar, including derivatives, you know, in higher orders like you're suggesting, then you would not get that phi as a superfield squares to zero. Indeed, we know that phi in the UV does not square to zero. Eventually, when you solve the equations of motion to high enough order, you recover the superfield itself, right? So indeed, phi does not square to zero. What I'm saying is that
phi flows at very low energies to something that squares to zero, and you can describe the theory in two different ways. One is to use the original degrees of freedom, and basically the original Lagrangian, so you don't gain anything. And the other is to use the superfield that it flows to at very low energies and write down Lagrangians with the superfield that it flows to and interaction terms with the superfield. Now you can ask whether this is always possible. And the answer is yes, you can always use this superfield that does satisfy the constraint and write interaction terms in the Lagrangian, or you could use a superfield that does not satisfy the constraint, like the original superfield. And this describes the same theory. You can show that there is a one-to-one mapping between these two procedures. Are there any additional questions?
Supergravity. So can you just naively couple supergravity multiplied to this XML,
yeah,
or
so
you have to redo the whole procedure?
So I can tell you what I know about supergravity, which is very little, because I haven't studied.
I haven't studied this in, you know, in great detail. In the literature, there is a claim that there is a non-unique way to gauge supergravity when supersymmetry is broken. And this claim is by Murayama and Aitani Hamed. And the only thing that I checked so far is that this claim is wrong, and there is actually only one way to gauge supergravity. So it might be that there is an easy way to generalize this stuff, supergravity, but I don't know. So yeah, I know that it's unique. That's the only way I can, that's the only thing I can say now. It's an open question.
Right. Yes.
I was going to ask you about supergravity, so maybe not fair. If you said that supergravity is going to go the way the Gauss theory went, and what you would have expected is that in the global case you have this Goldstone boson and a nonlinear realization is just telling me that you give me some random theory that's not invariant under the symmetry, I can make it invariant for free by coupling the Goldstone boson in some specific way.
Okay.
And that's more or less what the Goldstone fermion does for supersymmetry. But when you gauge that symmetry, as you said, if I have a gauge symmetry and I look at the low energy limit compared to the symmetry breaking scale, in the end of the day, what happens is that you essentially gauge away the Goldstone boson and it gets eaten by the gauge boson, and then there's no strain on the low energy Lagrangian coming from the symmetry at high energies that was broken. So the moral is that the low energies effective theory is not constrained by the symmetry at all.
Well, this is not true for a low. For example, if you remember. So let's discuss
parallel Lagrangians, where this can be like if you gauge it. if you gauge the symmetry very weakly, then suppose you gauge the symmetry extremely weakly in some kind of Lagrangian, then the longitudinal mode of the gauge field is this Goldstone boson, right? But this Goldstone, but the interactions of this longitudinal mode are not the same as the helicity plus and minus one guys, right?
You make the gauge bosons heavy enough that they're not.
Oh, if the gauging is strong.
Yeah.
Well, so there is no separation between the longitudinal mode and the helicity plus minus modes. If the gauging is strong, then indeed I don't know whether there are any constraints. But if the gauging is weak, which is what we're interested in the context of supersymmetry breaking, because the gauge coupling in supergravity is f over n plus. So if it's not weak, then it doesn't make sense to discuss supersymmetry breaking anyway. Then it's fine. But you don't have the same constraint, basically, for all energies.
I guess the way I should phrase it is that the three spin states, the three spin one spin states are degenerate.
But they're not. The coupling still.
Well, no, they couple in the integer voice. I noticed that, but if you pick the spectrum, and
the spectrum
is for me, the two cases that distinguish themselves are whether or not that those three states are in your lower integer or not.
Yes.
And in the case that they're not, then essentially there's no individual effect of the gauge symmetry. If you completely break it. So on the supergravity side, we kind of expect the same kind of statement, that if you have if the gravitino is heavy enough, then there'd be no constraints at all.
I agree. If the gravitino is heavy enough, then it doesn't make sense to discuss the supersymmetry breaking anyway, because the contributions from gravity mediation will be strong.
Right. So you're going to...
That's what I'm saying. When the gauge coupling in supergravity is f over n plus. If it's very weak, then all what I said should be an excellent approximation, and the corrections should be in f over m plus. If f over m plus is 1, then supersymmetry breaking doesn't make much sense, because you would expect m plus contributions to the soft scales of all the possible particles from gravity mediation. So,
somehow, if you can prove that, that would still be a useful thing, because even though people believe it's true, I don't know if anyone's actually proven it.
Yeah. So this case where f is large is exactly the case where there was a debate whether the gauging supersymmetry is unique or not. So this is a murky, I mean, this business has not been settled, and this debate is very recent. So there are two, you could imagine field theories. So you could, when there are two cases, like when the gauge cup, when f over m plus is 1. You could imagine theories in which you can continuously reduce f and, you know, eventually get to something that is sensible and calculable. And you could imagine theories in which you cannot do that, like for example, Shark-Schwarz composition, f over m plus being 1, and you cannot move it around. There aren't any free parameters. So this is exactly where the debate in the literature was, whether you can gauge when there are no free parameters that allow you to take f to be arbitrarily small, whether there are two different ways to gauge the symmetry. Anyway, so I'm just alluding to the fact that this question is open. It's largely open. Hasn't been settled. Even this basic question of whether it's unique to gauge supersymmetry or not is not known. That's what I have to say about it.
Any further questions? Okay, let's thanks.